Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bob McCoy. I'm Leanne Dofano. And you're the first case we'll hear this afternoon. And if you want to hang around to see an en banc case, there will be an en banc case at 2:30. Otherwise, you'll be free to go about your business when you're finished. Both sides ready, I understand? All right, then would you call the case, please?
The court will now call Leonard Hornsby and Sue Allen versus Tarrant County College District. May it please the court, Ms. Richard Lee Griffin and Ms. N. Sue Allen will argue for the appellant. Ms. Jennifer Covington will argue for the appellate.
Thank you, Richard.
May it please the court. My name is Richard Griffin. I'm arguing for Mr. Hornsby. Ms. Allen is also an appellant in the case and will be arguing for herself on question of disqualification as Mr. Hornsby's attorney. I also have a point on the disqualification of her as Mr. Hornsby's attorney. I'm going to, because of time, leave the bulk of that argument to her. I'm going to address the summary judgment question. I do want to say that there is, apart from her interest, Mr. Hornsby does have an interest in being able to choose and keep his own lawyer. And that's all I want to say about that, in addition to her standing and interest. This was filed as a race and age discrimination case. As a preliminary matter, we withdraw the age issue. It's not part of the case. However, summary judgment on the race discrimination case was improper and the case should be tried. The tenor of the appellant's brief seems to me to demonstrate of itself that almost every important fact is disputed in this case, except some dates, such as the date that a charge of discrimination was filed, and dates on or about when certain job postings were posted. Otherwise, it seems this case is full of questions of motivation, and cases like that are really not susceptible of summary judgment. It seems to me in writing the brief and reading the appellee's brief that the main battleground is an interpretation of whether the district was seeking a bilingual attorney or whether a district officer or an employee was requiring that a Hispanic person fill the position.
What is your damage?
Excuse me? The damages? The damages, in my interpretation, are financial losses from not having the job, from when it was not filled in 2005. Let me make sure I've got my dates right. The job was posted in 2004, and Mr. Hornsby was not selected. That is too remote from the filing to be part of the case. The job was re-advertised in the spring of 2005, and he applied. And the job was not filled on May 31st of 2006. Dr. Garcia wrote a letter to Mr. Hornsby saying that the job was going to be reposted. I would say that the damages would begin to run from around that time, whatever a reasonable time would have been had they not kept it open, had they gone ahead and filled it, which I would say would be sometime in the April and May period of 2006. I haven't looked at all the evidence in the record to see if that might not be further back.
What you're seeking in this lawsuit is the difference in salary for the period of time that you allege he should have been hired until he was hired.
That's right.
That's what all this is about.
Well, there are other elements of damages in this case. You know, other damages are recoverable under the Texas law. So it's not just the financial damages. But it is that, and it's attorney's fees if we prevail as well. So that, you know, until he was hired, right, from then to then. I believe that...
How does the disqualification of counsel dovetail into your appeal? It's almost like we have two rabbit trails running down together. I'm not sure how they merge together.
Well, from Mr. Hornsby's point of view, he picked an attorney, and he wanted to stay with the attorney.
But an attorney at any time can do something which may cause them to be removed.
Certainly, they can. But that just shows his interest in the question. It doesn't mean that the question has to be answered a certain way.
What I'm getting at is, how does the disqualification affect your case?
The disqualification affects my case.
What relief are you seeking based on what you allege is the wrongful disqualification?
Oh, I am seeking a reversal of the summary judgment and a reversal of the order disqualifying Ms. Allen so that she can resume representing Mr. Hornsby in the trial court.
How is the reversal of the motion for summary judgment predicated on the alleged wrongful disqualification of counsel?
Well, the record doesn't make a strong point on that, but let me tell you how I see it. I see that on the day in court that the summary judgment was to be argued, Mr. Hornsby was represented. Both sides were ready to argue the case. Ms. Allen was there to argue the summary defense, and the district's counsel was there to argue for summary judgment. However, that was passed until there was a ruling on the disqualification. And after that, there's no indication that Mr. Hornsby found counsel and was not represented thereafter except by himself. And that could have a big effect on how you respond to a summary judgment case. Now, I don't have in the record his efforts to find counsel or how frustrating that was or whether it was impossible or just something that didn't happen. So I can't show that. But I can show that he had a lawyer who was ready to argue the summary judgment, which was the very judgment that ended his case, and the decision to pass that until his lawyer ended up being removed, until that was decided, prejudiced him. That's my point on that. And I could say a lot of other things outside the record about the nature of the case, her familiarity with the college, many things. You know, we aren't fungible, and there are a lot of reasons that a person in Mr. Hornsby's position would want Ms. Allen in particular for his attorney. I wanted to say briefly something about the point in Appellee's brief that one of their issues was not raised on the appeal, one of the summary judgment issues. That is the question or the attack in summary judgment, that summary judgment should be granted because the administrative filings weren't made on time. And I reject that argument because under the general argument of that there's fact disputes on generation, on discrimination, facts presented both by me, referred to by me in the brief, but more specifically, facts set out in the appellee's brief establish what is and is not the correct, what are the facts, what is the correct situation on that. And that is, in summary, that the 2004 position, the denial for that, is beyond the scope of his charge, but that the 2005 position is not. Thank you.
Thank you. Sue?
May it please the court. My remarks will be about 7 minutes, and I will address in these minutes two primary arguments. The first one not necessarily taken in that term, but the first one, whether or not I, Sue Allen, have an interest in this appeal and should be allowed to participate in any way. The second one is whether or not I should have been disqualified from representing Leonard Hornsby. With the court's permission, I'll take those in reverse order and deal with disqualification first. This case involves the anti-contact rule of the Texas Disciplinary Rules of Professional Conduct 4.02. That rule clearly on its face prohibits absolutely communications with one represented by counsel. In this case, it is the 70 words in subparagraph 2 of 4.02 that includes as part of the entity or the governmental, or the corporation or the governmental entity, certain individuals. In this case, these are not managerial employees, and that's been conceded. There's no fee agreement here. They're not represented by counsel. And in fact, two of these individuals who were counselors at Tarrant County had sought me as their lawyer, and I represented them on many things having to do with their family. And therefore, I could have given myself permission to communicate with them. They're not represented by the entity. Because even if you are within the definition of a represented person of the entity, you're still free as an individual to hire your own attorney, and that becomes relevant in just a minute. Now, the distinction about who these individuals are under the Rule 4.02 becomes important because I believe what happened in this case is that it has been confused and fused with the purpose behind the rule, which is protecting the attorney-client privilege, with the evidentiary attorney-client privilege rule itself. And may I give an example? I can communicate with the employee of a corporation or an entity of government unless that person is within the definition of 4.022. And that is, he's not a manager, if his acts in connection with the subject matter of the lawsuit will not give rise to liability of the corporation, I can communicate with them. But by way of an example in this case, the college is alleging that I should not have communicated with two counselors and an academic advisor because those people served on several screening committees that went through hundreds of applications, narrowed it down to 80 or so, narrowed it down to 6 people to interview, narrowed it further to 4 or 5 or 6 people to send on to somebody else to interview. Now, in this case, the anti-contact rule doesn't say I can't communicate with them. It says I can't communicate with them without permission of the lawyer. So let's assume for a minute that the counselors and academic advisors in this case had confidential information they communicated with Ms. Covington's client. Even with permission from Ms. Covington to communicate with those people, it would be inappropriate for me to ask them the question, what did your lawyer tell you? What did you talk to Ms. Horn? What did you talk to Ms. Covington about? That's because the attorney-client privilege is sacrosanct. It is the college's to waive, and if the subject matter of the communications deal with my case, I can't communicate with them about it if those confidential communications were made to their lawyer. On the other hand, under 4.02, there is no subject matter test except for in as far as the main rule says I can communicate even with the represented party about something else, meaning the chancellor of the college is Irma Hadley, and I can communicate with her about some club activity. I can't communicate with her about the case. So that's why the subject matter rule becomes very important. So in this case, the really important consideration is, are those 70 words in paragraph 2 of 4.02 that basically includes within the definition of a represented party a person presently employed by the entity whose acts or omissions in connection with the subject matter of the suit may give rise to vicarious liability for such acts or omissions. And every time I start a case as what I think of myself as a private attorney general under the Texas Human Rights Act for race discrimination, age or disability discrimination, and I need to vet my case to figure out whether or not there's any evidence to support it, and I want to talk to certain employees of that business to know, or that entity to know if I can do that, I go through that rule and I ask myself, did anything this person did or anything this person said Can it give rise to liability for what that person did or said? Now, if I can give another example, because I thought about it in this way that made it very clear. Let's say we have the janitor in this building who leaves a mop out front and Judge McCoy trips over it. But say the other janitor basically has been taught when to put up the mop and certain rules. I believe under 4.02, I am free to communicate with the other janitor about his procedures for how he puts up the mop and his what he's been told about keeping the building safe. I can't communicate with the janitor who left the mop bucket out because his acts or acts or omissions give rise to the liability of the state of Texas. So two people, both of whom are janitors, I can communicate with the one about the case. Tell me about your procedures for putting up your mop, but not with the other because his acts and his omissions give rise to liability. That is a situation in this case. In a given case, I imagine that the screening committee members could do something that would make Tarrant County College liable for discrimination. But in this case, they did not do anything that would give rise to that liability. In fact, in this case, each member of the screening committee voted each and every time they saw Leonard Hornsby's application to send him forward to the next round of interviews. That's when their participation stopped. They had no ability to go any further in the hiring process. And the act that we are complaining about was actually made by the president of the South Campus, Ernest Thomas, who rejected the recommendation not only of Leonard Hornsby, but the recommendation of the former director. Now, let me very quickly, because I know the little yellow light is on, go to that former employee. Oops. May I have 2 minutes?
Talk until the red light turns on.
Thank you. Okay. That person who's a former employee, under the rules, a former employee is off limits. I can talk to that person, but I can't talk to anybody who has confidential information because that violates attorney-client privilege. And one final matter about my authority. My case is distinguishable from the situation of the person in Jackson and in this court's precedent in the interest of DHR because in those cases, Your Honor, they weren't disqualified as a sanction for their alleged unethical behavior. And Your Honors, in the rule.
Your time is up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Jennifer?
May it please the court, Jennifer Covington on behalf of Tarrant County College District. I'd like to first address an issue that I don't think has been mentioned yet by either of the appellants in this matter, and that is this court's lack of jurisdiction to consider this appeal. The summary judgment that Mr. Hornsby is appealing was signed on September 21st, 2011. The only notice of appeal that has been filed by Mr. Hornsby in this matter was filed on February 6, 2012, which is well beyond the appellate lines. We've set forth in our brief, even if you gave him a very generous estimate and the findings of fact and conclusions of law extended his notice period till December 21st, 15 days after that would have been January 5th, 2012. So he was well outside the timeline when he could have filed an appeal in this matter. Ms. Allen's notice that was filed on October 24th, 2010 does not give this court jurisdiction over Mr. Hornsby's appeal. The case that Ms. Allen just cited, N. Ray Samuel T. Jackson versus Abbott, in that court, the Austin Court of Appeals determined that the disqualification of an attorney must be given effect and is presumptively valid unless and until the appellate court reverses it. Well, this court rejected the appellant's petition for mandamus that was filed in February of 2011. So as of October 24th, 2010, Ms. Allen did not have authority to represent Mr. Hornsby in this matter. A similar decision was reached in another opinion that we cite in our brief, Pissarro versus Seidler, 2008 Texas Appellate Lexus 5307, pages 13 and 15. There, the Houston Court of Appeals determined that the trial court orders an attorney where the trial court had ordered that an attorney may no longer file pleadings on behalf of a party, that same attorney filed a notice of appeal on behalf of that same party, and the Houston Court of Appeals determined that that notice of appeal filed by that attorney did not give the court jurisdiction over the appeal. So I think it's very clear that Ms. Allen's notice of appeal filed in this case did not give this court jurisdiction to consider Mr. Hornsby's appeal. Likewise, as this court has previously determined, an attorney like Ms. Allen, in her particular situation, does not have standing to appeal her disqualification. The right to be represented by an attorney of your choice goes to the party, not to the attorney representing that party. And that was this court's decision in the interest of JMR, 2007 Texas Appellate Lexus 4112. That was likewise the decision in the Jackson opinion that I previously cited.
Counsel, couldn't Mr. Hornsby have filed an amended notice of appeal?
That would have still...
The initial notice of appeal was timely, correct?
The initial notice of appeal would have been timely as to Ms. Allen, assuming she had standing to file an appeal, yes. But it wouldn't have, pursuant to the authority that we've cited in our brief, it wouldn't have given this court jurisdiction over Mr. Hornsby. And I believe it was this court in, it's Muhat Mahaj, M-U-H-A-M-E-T-D-A-J versus Northern Trust Bank of California that decided even a reasonable excuse would not extend the appellate timeline. I'd like to move on to the merits of the summary judgment. With respect to the timing for the filing of Mr. Hornsby's charge of discrimination with the Texas Workforce Commission, we have asserted that with respect to the November 2004 postings of these positions, his filing with the Texas Workforce Commission, or EEOC, was not timely. As this court decided in the Villanueva versus Tarrant Regional Water District, which petition was just recently denied by the Supreme Court, and also in Texas A&M versus Chatha, pursuant to the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act, on which Mr. Hornsby's lawsuit is based, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, the idea under that statute that the timeline is extended with each paycheck, that doesn't apply to the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act. Instead, under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act, the unlawful employment practice occurs when the employee becomes aware of the alleged discriminatory decision. And in this particular case, it's uncontested that Mr. Hornsby knew in the spring of 2005 that he had not been selected for that November 2004 posting. So any allegations in this lawsuit relating to that posting would be barred by limitations.
I thought that that's what opposing counsel agreed to, but what about the other actions, the 2005, et cetera, et cetera?
With respect to the 2005 postings, I believe that Mr. Hornsby learned of that in May of 2006, and that he filed his charge of discrimination within the time frame after that. However, he didn't file any subsequent charges of discrimination for any subsequent postings, and his petition is limited to both the 2004 and the June 2005 postings. Moving on through the...
You're not trying to, let's say, avoid liability. You're trying to limit your exposure here.
Yes.
To the 2005 situation.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think... Yes.
Gotcha. I have a question for you. In your brief, we read more than once that when he didn't get the job, he was encouraged to reapply.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if it's true, the reason that he wasn't hired was because he wasn't bilingual, why in the world were you telling him to reapply? Why was he encouraged to reapply since he obviously wasn't going to become bilingual in the next 30 days or whatever?
I think that the facts, the undisputed facts set forth in our brief show that the district did have an interest in retaining there were two counselor positions that were open, and as set forth in the undisputed bilingual facts, Lily Calzada had filled that counselor position for the 4 years prior to any of these postings. She was bilingual, and the district had an interest in retaining a bilingual.
Why are you telling Mr. Hornsby to reapply when he's rejected, when he's not bilingual? You say that on one side, then you turn around and say, well, the reason we didn't hire him then was because he was bilingual. You knew he wasn't bilingual, so why encourage him to reapply?
That would have been based on the business decisions of the district as to whether or not they would have filled one or two positions at that time. Your Honor, quite frankly, it's not developed in the record, but there are financial issues involved in the district as to whether they're going to be able to fill one or two positions at any given time. So I think given that factor and not knowing who would continue to apply each time, that's why they encouraged Mr. Hornsby to continue to apply. And Your Honor had pointed out something earlier with respect to the Texas Labor Code. It brings to mind Texas Labor Code Section 21.125B, which goes to Mr. Hornsby's damages in this matter. Pursuant to that section, that when a respondent demonstrates that the respondent would have taken the same action in the absence of the impermissible motivating factor, the court may grant declaratory relief, injunctive relief, except as otherwise provided by the SEP section, and attorney's fees and costs demonstrated to be directly attributable only to the pursuit of a complaint under Section A, but may not award damages or issue an order requiring an admission, reinstatement, hiring, promotion, or back pay. And as we set forth in our brief, here we believe that we've conclusively established that Mr. Hornsby would not have been retained for the positions that he complains about, regardless of his race. The district had a need to fill the counselor position with a bilingual employee, and that did not speak to Mr. Hornsby's race. It went specifically to the skill set of whether or not the applicant was bilingual.
Well, I think that's the question he asked. Then why did you keep telling him to apply? He wasn't going to get bilingual overnight. Why did you keep telling him to apply if your reason really was that he wasn't bilingual and your reason wasn't because he wasn't Hispanic? And if you could find somebody who was Hispanic, then it'd be okay to take him. I mean, that sounds...
You know, you heard that there is some evidence that some higher up said, I want you to hire a Hispanic, not a bilingual speaker.
Yes, Your Honor, and that statement was made with, or Ms. Lynzetta Smith-Allen was recalling that statement that was allegedly made by Dr. Thomas, who is an African-American, or was an African-American president of the South Campus. And it was actually Dr. Thomas who ultimately retained Mr. Hornsby for the counselor position in 2008. After the college had retained a bilingual counselor. And it's also...
Does the record reflect whether the bilingual counselor was Hispanic?
Yes, the bilingual counselor that was retained was Hispanic. The record also reflects that there were numerous Hispanic applicants that were turned down in the 2004 and 2005 postings upon which Mr. Hornsby bases his complaint.
They're the ones that weren't qualified?
They were not otherwise qualified for the position, yes.
So being Hispanic was one of the qualifications?
No, Your Honor. Being bilingual was one of the qualifications. But to the extent that Mr. Hornsby would make the argument that that was some sort of a disguise as an attempt to try and retain a Hispanic, there were numerous Hispanic employees or applicants that were turned down in both 2004 and 2005, as well as individuals of other races. In order for Mr. Hornsby to prevail in this matter, he has to show more than just a bad business decision. The evidence must show a mistake of judgment large enough that one may wonder whether it was a mistake at all. And here, when you look at the qualifications of Ms. Carranza and Ms. Hornsby, other than the bilingual other than the fact that Ms. Carranza, who was hired, was bilingual, their qualifications are very similar. And I think that that shows that...
She has a master's degree in counseling?
Yes, she has a master's degree in education, which is Dr. Thomas testified was a degree that was a comparable field to counseling. She also had a minor in psychology as well.
But she had a minor in counseling and a certification.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, tab 8 to our brief shows that she had a master's in higher education and with a minor in counseling, Your Honor. We would just assert again that Mr. Hornsby was not turned down because of his race, but because the college had a legitimate business interest in retaining a bilingual counselor. All of the postings that are the subject of this suit, each of them had a desired qualification that the person be bilingual. And unfortunately, Mr. Hornsby was not bilingual. Once the college retained a bilingual counselor, it made the business decision to go ahead and hire Mr. Hornsby for the second counselor position.
Does the college have to show a need for a bilingual counselor?
With respect to demonstrating that they had a business necessity, which is part of the defense in this matter, then yes, we would. You may assert that the college would have to show a necessity for it, which we believe has been established.
Since none of the classes is taught in Spanish, and this is supposed to be university level, you're saying that you have students who don't speak English, and yet they're attending classes in English? And so they couldn't communicate with a counselor who doesn't speak Spanish?
Well, actually, Your Honor, what the undisputed bilingual facts that we set forth in our brief show that on a daily basis, the bilingual counselor that was hired, Ms. Carranza, she encountered a need to speak Spanish with the students and their family that came on to the South Campus. The counseling department is actually a point of entry for students when they begin their journey at Tarrant County College District. This is where they and their family discover what educational path
they were at Tarrant County College?
Their education with Tarrant County College District. This is where they begin their studies with Tarrant County College District. They come to the counseling department to determine what courses they're going to take, and a lot of times the people who come to the South Campus, they're more comfortable conversing in Spanish than English, and it's not just the students, it's their family members as well. Thank you.
Okay, on y'all's rebuttal, I would be interested, I'm sorry, I'm talking to them. I would be interested in hearing, which I've yet to hear, if there was a wrongful disqualification, what does that have to do with Hornsby's case? I haven't heard that yet. And secondly, please address her assertion about once you're disqualified, which makes sense to me, you can't do anything. You can't appear at a hearing, you can't take a deposition, you can't file a pleading, you can't file a notice of appeal because you aren't counsel. So I wish y'all would address those two issues for me if you have time.
Shot, Your Honor.
And I may be more directed to her. You know, I don't know, but however y'all feel comfortable.
I'll do what I can. When you say that the wrongful selection, are you talking about the person who got the job before he did?
No.
You're talking about his not getting the job.
If there was a wrongful disqualification, what does that have to do with the Hornsby's case? And secondly, if disqualification had occurred, I don't see how anything can be performed by counsel, including filing a notice of appeal. So that's kind of where I'd like to.
All right. Well, I will rely mostly on Ms. Allen for that.
Right.
Except to say this, if I don't muddy the water. Again, I point to the crucial procedural point at which the disqualification occurred. That the final judgment was based on the summary judgment
But of course, as we all know, summary judgment has nothing, you don't even not entitled to a hearing. You're not even entitled to a hearing on a motion for summary judgment.
There was going to be one.
But
it was right there.
No,
she was in court, they were in court.
At a summary judgment hearing, as you very well know.
No, the judge recites that the case was called and he didn't show. I believe the judgment recites that he had notice of a hearing on summary judgment, he didn't appeal. I believe, I haven't looked lately, but I believe that's in
that's
the final
correct.
Judgment.
That's what Greece.
Okay. The and on the, you know, I just happily accepted the court's invitation to file an amended notice for Mr. Hornsby. It seems to me that no, a disqualified attorney cannot act as the attorney in any capacity. But if there's a putative attempt, I mean, to invoke the jurisdiction of the court, for example, having somebody else do it for you, and then there's some defect that questions that, then there needs to be a way for the appellate not to lose on that point. In other words, either him filing himself afterwards or having me file for him, which is what happened. I'm not ready to cite you law or anything else, but you know, I do remember reading cases that say, you know, a good faith effort to invoke the jurisdiction of the court will not be defeated in, by certain failures which can be remedied. And in this case, I would hope that that's what happened. You know, very briefly on the, I just want to say that the question of business defense and such, that's just a real good, the question of business defense and such is really a good reason, is a good example of why this case was not a summary judgment case. They may have a business defense, but it's sure not developed, and they can't say it's conclusively established. I don't think anything in this case is conclusively established. I think there are contradictions all the way through, even whether or not bilingual was in the first job announcement. It's shown as a desideratum in the documents produced, but two different witnesses say the first job posting they saw, it wasn't on there. So from there on, there are factual disagreements that really call for interpretations of circumstances, credibility, and trying to divine the motives of people.
May it please the court. That is the crux of the matter. There are two points with respect to the efficacy of the joint notice of appeal. I filed on behalf of Mr. Hornsby and myself, and he just didn't sign it. So it's like almost an unsigned notice of appeal. But in this particular case, I believe the notice of appeal should be effective for both Mr. Hornsby and myself. I have to agree, because I could find no law, as hard as I searched, that would give me the right as a disqualified attorney to represent Mr. Hornsby. However, I found a way I have that right, and that is because when you read the Jackson case, that court in Austin talked about some of the cases cited by Mr. Jackson. And in that case, Mr. Jackson had been disqualified because he had, I think it was confidential information from the state about driver's licenses. In this case, I have been sanctioned. I would direct the court to the record at page 1589, 1590, and 1591, in which the court specifies that the reason Sue Allen was disqualified is because she engaged, this is paragraph 51, in conduct prohibited by the Texas Rules of Disciplinary Conduct 4.02. And in the Jackson case, the court points out that the problem with Mr. Jackson's case was is that it was the client's right to complain about disqualification of the lawyer, but as the sanctioned attorney, I have an interest in my reputation, in my ethics, which I believe in defending myself. I'm saying that I'm asking this court to distinguish the Jackson case, because in that case the issue was just disqualification for other reasons, not as a sanction against the attorney. In this case, my client did nothing wrong, and I don't think I did anything wrong. I didn't hear the college get up and say how in the world these counselors are within the umbrella of represented parties as a counselor and advisor, and that's a distinction. I have been sanctioned, and I have an interest in that as an attorney.
Your time's up. Thank you. We appreciate your argument. It's been very helpful. Appreciate your answering our questions. Your case is submitted, and this court will be in recess until we reassemble as a court en banc.